Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we are going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever. BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com. Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com.
Marco.
Sean, here we go again.
Here we go. I think I've been looking for something and I found it. And I'd like to share it with you.
What?
I'd like to disclose it. To you, if that's all
right. I don't know. You're taking some risk.
I am taking some risk in doing that. I know.
Sounds like you need to feel safe. You need safe harbor.
I do need to feel safe. And I'm not feeling safe quite yet. So I'm not going to share yet.
But if you were going to share something really important for me, for my safety, for example, why you wouldn't want to share it?
Well, because it might break the law. You never know. Depends what I'm disclosing. But
we're talking about hacking.
We're talking about hacking. And there are weaknesses in every system, software, hardware, whatever it is. Even us humans have them. And when they're exploited for bad things, it's not good for society. But when we recognize that those weaknesses exist and we can identify them and do something good with that information, that's a really cool thing. And there are lots of people doing that. You call them researchers, call them vuln identifiers, call them pen test, whatever you want to call them. They're hackers. Yep. And the problem is, Marco, and we're gonna hear from a good friend of ours more about the problem and how to solve it. But the problem is that the laws and rules of engagement aren't always clear.
That's right.
And therefore, when the activity begins, the problems identified could lead to some trouble for the person who found them. But
the good news is that there are some nonprofit organizations that came together, and together they work into allowing the hackers to do what they do and to do it feeling safe and protected. And
exactly.
In particular, we got a friend, Casey.
So this we can disclose.
We can close that.
Casey's with us.
This is the.
How are you doing, my friend?
Very well, thank you. That was a heck of an intro. I think I
know.
We took up half the time of our segment on this.
No,
story,
well, you pretty cleanly explained the problem set too. So that's a bonus.
We're just saving you time, but you know what? Let's start from the beginning. This is a segment that we're doing to introduce several organizations that are doing a lot of good for society by, again, getting hackers together and allowing them to be doing what they do best. And so we want to start with presenting this with
hacker.
You, but let's talk about the chief hacker, you. Tell us a little bit about you.
The hacker herder, so to speak. Yeah, so it's great to be chatting with you folk. My name is Casey Ellis. I am probably best known as the founder of the company BugCrowd. We didn't invent vulnerability disclosure or bug bounty programs, but we basically pioneered the concept of putting a platform in the middle of that process to make it easier for everyone involved. So that's usually what I'm known for when I'm talking to folk and all those sorts of things. One of the other things I've worked on for quite some time, really in parallel to BugCrowd, is a project called Disclose.io, and that's what we're talking about today. So yeah, that's me.
And so, Disclose.io, what was the spark that said we need this? And
yeah,
maybe the need has been understood for a while, but what was the spark that said, now's the time to create this thing? And how did that happen?
So you kind of laid it up well in the intro. You know, the laws and really this kind of nature of the rules of engagement between good faith hackers and people that build companies like software systems, whatever it might be, they're pretty vague. They're pretty ambiguous. And in fact, you know, the majority of laws that exist around hacking, around things like circumvention of controls, when you start to talk about, you know, copyright laws and so on, they really don't have a concept of good faith. They've been written assuming that anyone doing this type of thing is probably a criminal. So let's just write laws that reflect that. And if there's good stuff that happens too, we'll deal with it as it comes. And really the challenge to that is this kind of, you know, massive gray zone that exists around what is safe, what is unsafe, you know, for both sides, not just the security researcher and the finder, but the organization when they're considering inviting in the help of these people. Like, how do you do that in a way that everyone feels like, you know, they're not going to get their door kicked in by the FBI for doing something good, but also in a way that doesn't, you know, accidentally give the bad guys permission or legal cover to do bad things. So that was kind of the precursor problem. And it's, you're right, it's been around for a long time. I think the thing that's happened and that I've seen over the past, you know, 8 years with BugCrowd, you know, the growth of security research, full disclosure, bug bounty as a more kind of normalized thing. Like, that wasn't true when we started, and then it became true. So the amount of that activity going on kind of highlighted that problem. It's like, oh, this is creating a chilling effect. There's a lot of, you know, broken stuff on the internet. There's a lot of people that want to help. And this kind of legal ambiguity is really chilling their ability to do that. So, you know, really the origin of what is now Disclose.io was a kind of a combination of projects out of BugCrowd and out of CipherLaw in Washington, D.C. to standardize vulnerability disclosure policy language. Because the other thing with this ambiguity is that, you know, when lawyers get nervous about stuff, they tend to get verbose. So you get all these like War and Peace vulnerability disclosure policies sitting around on the internet that people that, you know, have English as a second language, for example, or don't have a legal background, really don't have a hope of understanding. So how do we simplify that? How do we make that easier to interpret and easier to adopt? Then fast forward a couple of years, Amit El-Azhari, I think, you know, kind of working with and partly inspired by some of the work that her sister Karen did with the whole internet immune system, TED Talk 7 years ago, I think this week, which is pretty cool. Started pushing this idea of legal bug bounty, which was really around how do we create carve-outs with a focus on safety, which is kind of where y'all started this conversation. Like, how do we make it clear, you know, what's okay, what's not okay, and if you stay within these boundaries of a definition of good faith, what kind of legal protections you can be afforded. So that was out of UC Berkeley. Dropbox came in and started doing something as well. And then basically I had the idea of basically, you know, bringing all of these things together under a banner called Disclose.io, putting it together as an open source project. We're in the process of pursuing not-for-profit status at the moment. And there's a myriad of people. I think this is, you know, the bug crowd origin of it can make it sound like a bug crowd thing, but it's coming in from all sorts of different places. Yeah.
Let's talk about the amount of people that are involved into this. But, you know, of course, if you're going to list them all, it's going to take the whole time that we have available, but it's a community. It's a community project, right? And it works for the community. But the thing that I also like, you mentioned the lawyers and the government agency, maybe all the ones that are on the other side. So it's something, I mean, ultimately, it's not just for benefiting the hacker community. It's for benefiting society and to keep a safer internet, a safer environment for anybody that use computers and apps and all of that. So
yeah,
what are you guys focusing on now? Because it kind of blows your mind if you start thinking of all the places where you can go.
All the variations.
There's some priority.
You're absolutely right. And that is really a big part of the use of open source into this. It's to build basically standardization through consensus. Like, the mission is to standardize and promote neighborhood watch for the internet. Everything that we do kind of rolls up to that core idea. And a lot of that language and that precedent hasn't been set yet. So that's really what we're trying to create a focal point around and continue to do. So far, so good. Like, this was used in the elections last year in the US, you know, to your point on who's contributing, we've had, you know, the Department of Justice opine on things. We've had the EFF come in and help out. We've had different like large organizations that have invested their own time from a legal standpoint, getting this language right, actually commit back to the repo and help to improve the language. So this is the sort of community, you know, power that we've drawn into this thing and that we're continuing to kind of push forward. I think the other side of it is the promote piece that I mentioned before. Like what we've just dropped with a recent revision of the terms is this introduction of essentially a maturity model. So if you're running a program of any sort and actually, you know, basically inviting or giving people a way to report security issues to you, like to what degree are you actually applying best practice in that? Like at the bottom of the heap, you've got things like security.txt, which is better than nothing. It's not something that everyone's doing, but it doesn't really help people understand what's legal and what's not. Right at the top of the pile, you've got what we call full safe harbor, where you've basically authorized people to do testing, as well as coordinated vulnerability disclosure. So you're basically proactively saying that researchers can talk about these issues once they've been fixed. So, yeah.
So are there any examples, Casey, where, I don't know, because I what I'm picturing is that this could have gone on like this for quite a while. And I think, I don't know, there's nobody been prosecuted yet, right? I think there's some cases in play, no prosecution. So presumably it could have continued as it is, but eventually it's going to blow up, right? So I don't know what.
Yeah, I would actually disagree on the prosecution side. Yeah, and you're right in that, you know, for example, the CFAA, the vast majority of the cases that get tabled are, you know, people that's you know, have done things that you would consider to be legitimately criminal, right? But I mean, even this week, like Rob Dyke with the NHS, you know, being kind of basically slapped over the wrist under the auspices of the Computer Misuse Act in the UK, like he was trying to help out. This was legitimate, you know, security okay. research. He found credentials in GitHub. He tried to tell them that. They freaked out. And basically kind of invoked, you know, the higher authority of the backdrop laws that exist. That's really, I think, the bigger problem. It's the idea of this overall kind of chilling effect that exists as a baseline. And then you see still fairly frequently, I think, organizations invoke those laws to basically tell, you know, researchers to behave themselves. And it's not even necessarily about them behaving themselves. It's just like, I don't like what you just told me. So I'm frightened. You know, I'm reacting maybe in a way that's driven by fear or shock or surprise or embarrassment even. So I'm going to pull in this you know, criminal law to basically try to control your behavior. That shouldn't happen. That shouldn't be an option, I think, for organizations, because this should be a normal conversation that we're able to have on the internet, because vulnerabilities exist. That's just true. It, like the fact that you're trying to ignore that doesn't mean it's not true. And I think that's becoming more and more obvious.
Yep. And vulnerability exists everywhere, me there. Right?
Yeah.
It exists everywhere, you know, and it's nice when people point it out and we fix and we move on and we make things better. So
I'm yeah. human. I just made a mistake.
Exactly.
Yeah. I got called out on it.
The closer we can get it to that, the better. It's like, you know, to err is human. Like humans write software, humans aren't perfect. QED, vulnerabilities yeah. exist. It's not a product of even necessarily negligence or people, you know, being silly or doing the wrong thing. It's just a thing that happens as a exactly. baseline. So the closer we can get to that being an accepted truth, then the more we can get on with like, okay, where is there something wrong that needs to be fixed? And let's actually focus on the users and their safety instead of, you know, our own embarrassment.
And we are at the time in our history where you can't just pretend it doesn't exist anymore. You can't pretend to hide something and people are just not going to notice. I mean, we're in the internet. We are a global village. We're going to see something if it's wrong. So this is a conversation that we had for a long time. We're going to have many more about the hacking community and the importance of everything they do for society. But this is more of a snippet that we're having about Disclose.io. So sure. To finish and to wrap it, Casey, a call to action for who is this for and people can get involved into Disclose.io.
Yeah, so the ultimate goal is to become almost like the green padlock for the internet, but when it comes to vulnerability disclosure, for people to be able to look at a site, whether you're a researcher, whether you're a peer of an organization, or even a consumer, see this kind of seal as an indicator of best practice, and say, okay, I'm more comfortable. I actually know what to expect now. So really, the easiest way, and I think the most straightforward way for organizations to get involved, is to look at the language and consider implementing it. Consider contributing back, update your position in the listing, all of those different things. On the researcher side and on the finder side, and even lawyers, people that are contributing in an individual capacity, look at what we're doing from a repo standpoint. Help out. Like we need all the help that we can get to make this thing more resilient. Go talk to people about it and actually say, this is something that you can do. It's not commercially tied to anything. You can engage companies like Bugcrowd to help you actually running these things, but you don't have to. The point is to get the language right and to make this a normalized thing. And that's actually the top priority of the project. So those are two things. The other is that we've started to basically crowdsource the idea of getting people in contact with the right person if they're struggling. So we're doing that on community.disclose.io. That's a really common problem, and usually what ends up happening is I'll get a phone call and asked if I know a guy, and there's a bunch of different people that kind of end up receiving those phone calls. Like, we're trying to distribute that problem solution set out to a broader audience. So any help that the audience can have with that, or if that's of interest to them, they can go there and check that out as well.
Very cool. And hopefully in there you have lawyers and policymakers and
most definitely
law enforcement. Yeah. and.
It's a long list, and to Marco's point before, I could enumerate all of the things, but that would take a very long time. So I think you're only getting the gist of it at this point.
Yeah. We'll do a piece at a time.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll end with the community bit, and take this time to thank you, Casey, for sharing with us a bit about disclose.io. Always good to chat with you.
I am very thankful to have been able to feel safe in disclosing information about this project to you. Cheers for that.
Cheers to that, man.
Marco.
Sean.
Is it time to do some research?
I want to go back to school.
That would be a nice thing, right?
Are you paying for it?
I'll pay for it. We're... Yeah, this could go down a whole path. It's probably not a good path. But
I think no. It's a good path. We're all learning, right?
We're always
life
learning.
Is learning, and we're learning, especially and even more when things change so fast. We can't just learn something and pretend that we know everything, because some new problem arise, and technology keep moving forward. So we have even issues.
Well, we solve one problem, we create two in the process, right?
Yeah, and issues that we didn't think it were an issue 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, then now we have to talk about it. And so in this series, we are talking about hacking. And that's an important topic, Sean.
It is an important topic. And the whole goal for this is to kind of perhaps even re-educate folks on what a hacker is. And early on, I often refer to them as researchers, in fact, because to this point of we create something and we put it in play and we let it fly and we don't know how it's going to change over time. Let's create an electrical grid, and then at some point, okay, let's connect it to the internet. What's going to
happen? See what happened.
Right? So that's just a very big, broad example, but everything follows that same model, right? You connect it to the internet, you bring more data to it, you bring more power to it, whatever it is, it's going to change how society uses it, could change, right? So research is great. And we're gonna bring a researcher's perspective to this conversation in Jack Cable, coming to us from Stanford. Jack, thanks for joining.
Glad to be here.
To kick it off, a quick word about yourself and a few things you've been up to, and then we'll get into it.
Great. So I'm a current student at Stanford studying computer science. I got into the world of security when I was in high school, so maybe about 5 or so years ago now, through bug bounty programs. So I've participated in a bunch of them for a bunch of different companies, got involved with some of the Department of Defense bug bounty programs in particular, placed first in one called Hack the Air Force. And that led me to work at the Defense Digital Service the summer after high school. So there I helped with their Hack the Pentagon program, got to see how things work on the other end for securing government systems. The Pentagon was the first government agency to launch a vulnerability disclosure policy, as well as a bug bounty program. So I worked there and then went to Stanford, where I'm a current junior. I've also worked at CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, on election security, so helping to protect the 2020 election. And a big part of that also was engaging hackers to proactively test systems before the election.
Yeah, that's a lot of experience.
To be honest, we do. A lot of systems with a lot of consequences associated.
For sure. But also being able to see these issues from a lot of different angles, I think it puts you in a very unique position. And actually, what I would like to talk about with you and hear your perspective is how university and academic entities position themselves towards this. Like on one way, you're teaching computer science, you're teaching psychology, social engineering, whatever you want to teach that is related to hacking, because hacking obviously is not just hardware or getting in other people's computers, even if a lot of people think it's that. So how is the position of a research group in a very esteemed, very much esteemed university like the one that you're in, and how it can help society in general to create more ethical hackers and change the perspective on what they do?
Mm-hmm. So I think that, so when I came to Stanford, one of the things that surprised me was that, like, Stanford is a world-renowned university for its computer science program. You would think that would be, say, really advanced in security, that it would be integrating security into the classes to make sure that people come away not only knowing how to code, but how to secure it. And then also on the other end, essentially training hackers, people who can quickly spot flaws in code, better secure programs. But one of the things I saw was that the security resources for, say, courses at Stanford are pretty limited. So for the undergraduate security curriculum, there's only one security course in the computer science department that touches on some of the more practical skills. Beyond that, there's some theoretical courses, but nothing that really goes deeper into what you need to do to secure a system. And further than that, that's isolated from the rest of the courses. So students could go throughout their 4 years without even completing a single security course, without thinking of security at all. So I think that universities have a large responsibility to produce people who can not only write the code, but also secure it. And from what I've seen right now, there's really a lack of that education integrated throughout when people are starting computer science. So one of the big takeaways is that universities should really encourage this more, should educate their students, and also allow them to, say, hack on their own system. So I helped start a bug bounty program for Stanford. So all of this combined, I think just there needs to be a greater focus on security for those studying computer science.
Yeah, excellent, Jack. And I'm wondering, research can be so many things. And the first thing that I think of is creating something new, kind of to your point, right? And what you're also describing is breaking something that's been created. And I'm wondering, do you see any movement where the process of break as you create is happening in your research group?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm a part of a couple of research groups at Stanford. One is the Stanford Internet Observatory, which focuses on the effects of disinformation on the internet. Another called the Empirical Security Research Group, which looks more towards, say, can you measure the current state of security on the internet? I think through these, definitely, like you say, yeah, you can either go about by creating something new or breaking the existing system or breaking something as you build it. And really, I think that in order for research to be productive, it isn't always the best just to break it and not offer any suggestions to how to improve it. So if you're finding a new attack that can affect, say, systems across the world, I think it's really important that like, because security researchers all the time love to say like, hey, look how broken this is, but not really offer anything concrete that can improve the state of security for everything. So going a step beyond that, saying here's maybe a new paradigm for how we can better secure systems as a whole, to do that along with these, say, attacks.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, are ethics a part of these conversations and curriculum and discussions and everything? Because looking at what's right, and even just the definition of what is right, and having a conversation of what do you go after, how do you go after it, how far can you take it, what do you share, how do you disclose it, and doing that in a way that's meaningful but also safe for the researchers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think certainly when you're doing any sort of security research, especially in an academic setting, those ethics questions are really important. So one of the courses that I've helped teach, which is pretty new at Stanford, is called Hack Lab. So that's taught with Alex Damos, the former chief security officer at Facebook, as well as Rihanna Pfefferkorn, who's a research scholar at the Stanford Internet Observatory. And Hack Lab is a course that is half practical hacking, so what you'd be doing every day if you're a pen tester, and half the law of cybersecurity. So Professor Stamos and Professor Pfefferkorn teamed together to teach those two aspects of it. And I think that fundamentally you can't really study security without seeing both of those aspects, because I'm sure, as you've discussed before, the knowledge to hunt for vulnerabilities is incredibly powerful, and there's kind of these two sides of what you can do with it. So it's really important to know, one, what are the limits of what you can do under the law? How can you engage in productive conversations to report vulnerabilities to companies that want you to be doing that under a vulnerability disclosure policy? And really just how you should engage in productive security research. So I think that really any time that you're doing this sort of thing in the academic context involves ethics review boards, which go a step further and study what other kinds of impacts you might have. But that's really essential to when you're teaching security.
Yeah, I'm glad that you went there, because I was going to ask you about the law, because a big part of this conversation that we're having as we're presenting nonprofit organization or research group like yours that you're part of at Stanford is the fact that, sure, you can go out there and chant and scream that we need hackers and they're doing the right job, and not every hacker is a bad person, is a cyber criminal, and that's where the distinction is. But if the law doesn't follow suit with this, we have a problem. We can scream as much as we want. We're going to need the revolution or something like that. So you're actually part of a big law university, very famous all over the world. I'm wondering if you have an insight of what the law courses and how, if and how they are preparing the future lawyer, the future people that are going to represent us at the government to be conscious about these technology changes. Anything you can say about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think definitely the intersection of technology and the law is really crucial. And part of what we look at in the Hack Lab course, for instance, is what parts of the law can we adapt to make this process easier? Because when you're looking at vulnerability disclosure policies, for instance, a common thing that they include is a safe harbor to authorize the types of testing that you're doing under a vulnerability disclosure program. And that's a really crucial part to have in these policies, and something that we've started seeing more organizations adapting. But really, the safe harbor policy is just kind of patchwork, because the existing law is insufficient to allow security research activities, because by default, most types of security research is against the law unless the organization specifically allows it. But there's really room to have a more productive conversation to take, say, with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which was created, I think, over 35 years ago. So when the internet didn't even exist for the most part, it was nothing like the way it was today. So thinking through how we can adapt that to better foster the types of security research that we see today that companies and the government are asking people to go out and do. So I think that's going to be really crucial as we start thinking about the next generation of hackers and how we can continue engaging hackers to confront some of these security problems that are really taking over the world in some ways.
Yep.
You can't ignore it.
I know. You know what I love about this conversation is the number of times we've used and heard the word hacker in the proper context. This is a gazillion times and I love it. And Jack, I want to thank you for your time and for your insight here and for all the work you've done on so many critical systems. We'll include some links to the research groups that you are part of, Jack, and some of the work that you've done with CISA and whatnot. I want to thank you.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com. BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.